You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
What a powerful notion. That notion of citizenship is, and just hearing that line again reminded me how we've kind of lost meaning of that and what it is in its truest form. And I saw the film actually last August in a small cinema in Devon, and at the end of the film, they didn't have Ken Loach coming on after the film, of course, but at the end of the film there was just this silence. Actually, there was some sobbing, but mainly silence. No one moved. At the end of a film, normally people stand up to leave or go to the toilet. No one moved, and it seems incredible. Someone else told me an experience where they saw the film and someone tapped them on the shoulder at the end and said, "Was that all true?" And I guess my first question is, how have we got to the point as a society where we don't even know whether that story is true or not? Because it is true.
Yes, yes. Yes, I mean, it's one of the less extreme stories that we could have told. I mean, there were many... we heard so many stories, as you can imagine... story after story of people who had died after they'd been declared fit for work. I mean, one of the women in one of the campaigns has got a banner of embroidered with portraits of people who've died after they've been declared fit for work. And there are there's one particular case, which is case of Michael O'Sullivan, who had many health problems, physical and mental health problems. His doctor and consultant said, in no way should this man work. Whether it was one of the private corporations who has the job of overturning those decisions, whether it's Maximus who are doing it now, said, yes, of course he must work. And he was very diligent. He went to every appointment. He found a job which he knew he couldn't do. And the day before he was due to go to work, he killed himself. And the coroner found, a very senior coroner, found that the DWP had direct responsibility for his death. Not the only factor, the man was ill, but had direct responsibility for his death. That has been put before the DWP, and there's not a word. Not a word. Totally ignoring a legal judgment that they are responsible for a man's death. So, yes, we could have told many, many stories. And we wanted to find... Paul Laverty wrote the script, and, I mean, is an extraordinary writer. And he and I decided we wanted people to be subject of the films who have no outward problem. You know, they're not the characters beloved of the TV programmes where, you know, you find some poor, unfortunate woman who's had more children than she can support, or somebody with an addiction. They're like the vast majority of people in this situation. They would sit amongst this audience and no one would suspect that they had a problem. In fact, there may well be people here who are having a problem and we don't know. There are hundreds of thousands. And I suppose what we felt was, there are hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people who know this story is true, and yet it's not part of our public discourse.
You said that you selected one of the less extreme cases that you... I mean, presumably there was a sifting process. It sounds quite sort of bureaucratic, but you and Paul must have gone through a process of considering many stories.
Yeah.
And, of course, the drama is a key element of it. But beyond that, were you thinking about how this might land in political conversation and political discourse and public discourse? And was that part of the reason for choosing this story over some others?
Yes, and also needing to build a relationship in the film, you know. So we wanted a man who was on his own, and isolation is another key factor of people who are in this situation. You know, poverty causes isolation because, I mean, he's a guy with friends at work. He'd love to go to the pub, but he can't put his hand in his pocket, so he doesn't, because he's too proud to not be able to stand his round. So poverty isolates people. And And so we wanted a relationship where they would eat, the two people would reveal themselves to each other because they were strangers. So hence a woman with kids leaving London, which obviously, I mean, many thousands have done, found somewhere where the rents are cheaper, so that her housing benefit will pay for the rent, so the local authority doesn't have to pay. So all these mechanisms of poverty isolate people.
Yeah, and there's a mechanism. I mean, we're very judgmental as a species, of course we are. But there's something about the system itself which encourages us to be judgmental of one another, and that in itself is an isolating thing, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, when the whole welfare system was set up after the war, it was a time of full employment, yeah. And it's interesting, the whole notion of benefits being a big issue. It wasn't an issue at the time because there was full employment. I mean, everybody had to work. We had to reconstruct the country. Houses, jobs, factories, everything had to be reconstructed. Or a lot had to be reconstructed. There was a job for everyone. The benefits culture came into being when Margaret Thatcher created mass unemployment. And it went from, 500,000 to 3 million in a matter of months. And suddenly, the system that was put in place in the time of full employment, due to that Tory policy, produced mass unemployment, and suddenly they had to find benefits. So suddenly there was a stigma. And that stigma has been underlined ever since. And the papers who drive the idea of the stigma hardest are the ones who welcome the mass unemployment. And there's an irony there, really.
It is, and I was looking at some of the numbers to refresh my mind today. And what's interesting, of course, job seekers allowance claims have gone down as the economy has recovered and jobs are being created. Employment and support allowance, which is the benefit that Daniel tried to claim and couldn't, has remained flat. So despite this system, it hasn't budged at all. Despite what's going on in the economy, it hasn't budged at all, which says that there's a real embedded need there, and there's almost no bureaucratic response that can dislodge that.
No, and another element that I haven't looked at the figures recently like you have, but that I think is rising is the in-work poverty.
Yes.
Because as the gig economy and the work is becoming temporary, casualised, done through agencies, so-called self-employed, you know, well, you're not self-employed really, you're working for someone, but you're deemed self-employed. And this has increased, and I believe there are now 7 million people in poverty where one of the members of the family is in work. Mm. So the working poor who can't survive on the wages they're paid have to be supported. So what we're effectively doing is subsidising labour for employers because they don't pay a wage to sustain people. So we're subsidising cheap labour. We're also subsidising landlords for charging excessive rents. So this claim, oh, cut the benefits, great. Cut the benefits, pay the living wage and cut the rents and then you'll cut benefits.
Yeah. Now, I mean, a lot of the reaction to the film has been predictable on both sides of the debate. The Daily Mail was true to form and I think we can kind of just sort of take that as read. But have there been any sort of surprising reactions that you had, maybe in private? You know, for example, there are MPs in their surgeries every week come across the reality of this system, whatever political complexion they are. But I'd just be interested to know whether some of the reaction maybe across the aisle has surprised you or not.
No, I think we expected the far right to attack us, and I mean we'd have been sorry if they hadn't, actually. I mean it's a badge of honour, you know, you wear it across the thing, you know.
Job done.
Attack abused by the Daily Mail. I mean, great. Now I think what always is surprising is just the intensity of people's responses. I mean we had a screening in to where the two by-elections are, Stoke and Copeland, this week. And the one in... in both of them, people just got angry. They just get angry. Some people walk out and leave. And they were both in on council estates, which are not in the centre of even in the centre of Stoke, it wasn't there. It was on an outlying part, and the same in Whitehaven, in Cumbria, and people just get desperate, and you just story after story is told, story after story, and it's very distressing for people, and I think it's distressing mixed with anger, and my fear is that the anger becomes focused so that, you know, it has a political voice.
Yes, and did you read that anger as being because you were challenging some assumptions, or because it reflected their reality, which obviously is upsetting?
It reflected their reality. This is another surprising thing. The distributors, E1, have... normally the film goes in the cinema and then some months later the DVD comes out, and that's it, and that's great. But on this one, E1 have nominated someone in their company to be responsible for what they call community screenings. And you can phone up E1 or email this guy, Ben Metcalf, and he arranges for you to get a DVD or whatever it is you need, and they charge £80. And then the people putting it on can charge money. They can raise money for food banks, which a lot have done. And within 2 or 3 months, we've had 500 screenings. 500! That's extraordinary. And there's probably at least 100 people in each one. So that's another 500,000. We've just been completely overwhelmed by the response, it's hugely extraordinary.
Yes. Movement around a movie, which is fascinating. Mm. Now, for obvious reasons, people have drawn comparisons between this and Kathy Come Home. It investigates a number of, a similar plethora of complexities and tripwires that people who are in a downward spiral face. But, reflecting back on Kathy Come Home, which is 1966, and I, Daniel Blake, in 2016. How would you compare the reaction that you felt? And what does if there is a different reaction between the two times, what does it say about the type of country we've become as opposed to the type of country we were in 66?
I think it's quite different. It's quite, in some respects, it's the same, because people didn't realise that homelessness, that families could be, in Kathy Come Home, the family is split because they haven't got anywhere to live. So the kids are taken into care, and the parents are split because they won't house the father. So that shocked people. But I think what is different now is that we, in the 60s, there was still a remnant of that post-45 settlement, where people felt that there was people worked for the social good, and the common good. Mm-hmm. And people felt, well, we're working together for something, and we accept that housing is a collective responsibility. Yes. And it was only, 15, 16 years since Nye Bevan had been building the council houses, with indoor loos, because he didn't want the kids to have to walk upstairs through the carpet to go to the lavatory. Fancy a housing minister thinking that now. Put it out to wimpies, they'll do it. So the sense that we work together for the common good, because that's how the war had been won, was still the prevailing consciousness. Mm-hmm. And now the prevailing consciousness, we know what it is. It's The Apprentice, it's The Dragon's Den, is how are you going to make profit? I don't believe you're going to make profit. You're not on the show no longer. I'm not going to work with you. You're my competitor. I'm going to do a deal with you. It's deals, competition, aggression. And that's the mood. And it's about private greed anymore. I'm running a rant now, but that's...
No, that's fine.
But that... If you think, it rather amuses me when they talk about political correctness. And political correctness is seen as... You don't say something unkind to a group who is vulnerable. If you're going to say something too unkind, say it to a middle-aged, white, rich man, then you can get away with it. But for people who are vulnerable, that's not very kind. So don't say it. That's political correctness. The real political correctness, I think, is you can't challenge the market. You can't challenge free trade. you can't challenge the right of business to be everywhere. And it's interesting that a test for politicians now is, are you anti-business? You're anti-business. Get out. You shouldn't be here. You know, well, yeah, I think we should be anti-business, actually. We should be anti-business that creates zero-hours contracts, that creates self-employment that isn't self-employment, that exploits people, creates precarious work, that destroys the environment, that is a part of our public services. I think that's the political correctness we've got to challenge.
And attitudes towards welfare are part of the political correctness as well. I mean, across the political spectrum, you hear some really hard attitudes towards welfare, and obviously that's the context into which this situation can emerge. And where do we go from here, Ken? Do we aim to recreate something akin to the post-war settlement, or do we need something new for new times? What's your sense of the direction on that?
I've got a fairly fundamentalist belief, which, I mean, I don't know if you share, but I think wherever you go, people need work. You know, that the work is the heart of it. If you have a job, it defines who you are. You're making a contribution. You are a functioning member of society. And I think public investment in the areas that have been left desolate since the early 80s, that's fundamental. And that has to be public investment, not a question of tempting big corporations to come in, to depending on how well they can exploit the people of the area. It's public investment. And I would say we need to own the industries that spring from that. I think it's removing corporations from our public services entirely. I think it, as regards this, it's... Debbie Abrahams is here, and Debbie is the shadow DWP minister. And I think we agree that the work capability assessment has to be scrapped, that your doctor has... your consultant that we rely on for our lives... should say, yes, this guy, this woman can't work, you know, and we should believe them. And the whole punitive sanctions regime has to go. And, I mean, for example, you go into a job centre and the job coach can have a list of the jobs that you could do on their screen, but they can't show you. They can't actually show you. And you're sitting there needing to work, wanting to find work. They can't show you. They can't help you with a form, even though, like, I mean, we've met so many people who are just not... they're of a generation that isn't quick with IT. They can't just help you fill in the form. And it's meant to help you. I mean, what kind of nonsense have we allowed to be created? So I think all that needs to change at that level. But the big thing is we redefine what is public, and we publicly invest in work. Because I think if people can stand tall when they say, I contributed to that, you know, that's what I did. You know, you walk in the street, a builder, a chippy or whatever, and that self-respect of making a contribution with a wage that is will enable you to live with dignity, I think that's critical.
Well, we certainly think there's a very strong case for the dignity of work and supporting that and giving people a bedrock of security to pursue decent work, and decent work's important. Mm-hmm. And there is a strong case for rebalancing investment in some of the ways that you're talking about geographically. And quite clearly we're experiencing some of the symptoms of failing to do that for too long. Mm-hmm. At this point, I'm going to open it out to the audience, and I'm going to take it in sort of banks of three questions, if that's okay. And then we'll see how we go. But I'm sure there's lots of thoughts.
And comments. Doesn't have to... there's lots of comments experts here, I'm sure.
But no speeches.
No.
We'll have Jan here, this gentleman here. We'll take those two for now.
Ken, Jan Portillo from Gateshead.
Ah, right.
Thank you so much for magnifying the voices that I recognise that often don't have a voice. You can hear mine cracking. I'm interested to know, when you started the process of making the film, what mattered to you most then, and perhaps what matters to you most now about I, Daniel Blake? And then, if I may, a supplementary, which is, given that thing or those things of what matters to you most and what's most important to you about the film, What contribution do you think the RSA might make towards that thing?
Thank you very much indeed for the film and previous films and very many things besides. It's great to be able to watch and hear from you. I take your points about business and its proliferation and political correctness. I work in business. I suspect many people here do. It occurs to me that roughly half people voted for Brexit, roughly half voted for Remain. Something similar happened across the Atlantic, and it seems to me that there are people that value society and fairness and compassion. And my experience is working in business is that some businesses do too. Some are like Goldman Sachs and want to, you know, rip the face off their clients or whatever it is in search of profit, but not all of them do. And I work with some businesses that are trying to do the very best that they can. I'm actually looking at inequality at the moment, and I'm looking at it with some very large businesses in the UK. And what we're quite keen to do is to work out what is good business policy and business practice in regards reducing inequality. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
It's a memory test now.
The first one is what matters to you when you made this and at the end now, and what can the RSA do?
Yes. I think what mattered to us at the beginning was just telling the stories, just to tell the stories with the most economy and the greatest simplicity that we could, with no tricks, with just should appear plain. I mean, it isn't plain, but it should appear absolutely crystal clear and economical. And you know, there's a great quote from Brecht about where he says wrote a poem in. I only know the bad English translation, but he said, I always thought the simplest of words must suffice. When I say what things are like, it will break the hearts of everyone. And I think that simplicity, if you can just make it just so clear and unadorned, so that's what we tried to do, to tell that story. I think what matters to us now is drawing the political conclusions, because I think it's and it's always a difficult dilemma because when you make a film, a film like this that is not a documentary where you can cut things, you know, bang up against each other. I mean, this is told in a very traditional way, you know, and it's just these people. So the film has to have the consciousness of the characters. You know, they can't suddenly step out, or you can't suddenly parachute a character in who's going to start saying what you want the audience to think. You know, the audience would turn away. So, but equally, you don't want it to be, well, ambiguous in some respects, in the way characters respond. There's a lot of human ambiguity about them, but the essence of the situation is pretty clear. You know, I mean, some people try to interpret it as saying that it was a great film in favour of a small state because it showed that food banks will step up to the mark. Well, that isn't what we wanted to say, fairly evidently. So I think what matters to us now is joining the dots and saying, look, this is the consequence of destroying communities. This is a consequence of wrecking whole communities where work has gone. This is what you have produced. And so to draw the political conclusions, it matters now, I think. What can the RSA... I'm going to ask you what the RSA can do, really. I think that's... You're asking the wrong person. I think there's a lot you can do. I mean, just put your head above the parapet, you know. Just argue for that we don't do this. I mean, argue to end the work capability assessment. Argue for work. Argue for public investment in work. That will do it. It's the only way, you know. It's the only way. They've tried the market. It doesn't work. Now we've got to try the other. What can business do? Oh dear me, well, you're asking me a tough question there. I mean, I I think stay small. Don't get taken over. Stay so that you can make ethical choices without a big owner telling you, sorry, that's for the birds. You make profit or you're out of a job. I mean, I think that's... I mean, set your face against the Alan Sugar view of business, which is to... which is profit at all costs. Stay small. But, I mean, who am I to tell you?
Let's take another couple of questions.
40 years ago, the government was seen as having responsibility for unemployment. I mean, notoriously, the Labour isn't working poster. And since then, government has managed to abdicate all responsibility. And we saw very clearly in the CV writing workshop that although he was able to quote the figures for how many people had applied for the job at the coffee shop, it was still seen as the responsibility of the individual to find work rather than the responsibility of government to provide work. And perhaps you could comment on that.
Thank you very much. A question, a comment more I have was I was looking at this and thinking about the difficulty you were showing so well and so powerfully. And I was imagining being myself a migrant, a white migrant, nevertheless a migrant, and try to navigate the system when I moved to England 2 years ago. And, you know, I am a lecturer and I'm educated and finding very hard sometimes just to find a doctor. And how complicated it can be when it's not your system and you're on your own. I was wondering about if you're aware or if you can comment on the difficulty of being part of this when you are an ethnic minority and when maybe you don't speak the language. So you don't only cannot use the computer, but you, maybe English is not your first language and you are very isolated because you might have nobody else in this country who you are connected to. So if you can comment on that.
As Ken pointed out, sorry Ken, we have got Debbie Abrahams, who's Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, and maybe Debbie, you'd like to say one too.
Thanks very much. Good evening, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've spoken with Ken and met Ken really since the first screening of the I, Daniel Blake movie. I think this is probably my third or fourth time I've seen it, and I couldn't speak after I saw the first viewing. It was just so emotional, and it did, as has been said, it reminded me of too many of my constituency, and my constituencies in the north of England, in Oldham, north of Manchester. And I have got some horror stories that I could mention here to you. But I wanted to pick up on a couple of points, specifically about, for example, the changing culture and value around the social security system. Ken said in terms of when it was established, why it was established, and the general erosion in terms of how we view the social security system. It has got particularly bad over the last 7 years. I mean, there was a study from the University of Oxford that actually looked at the use of language in the media, and including press releases from government and the Tory party. I'm sorry, obviously I'm a Labour MP, but I believe very much in evidence, and what I'm saying can be validated. And it showed that the use of the language shirk and scrounger had gone up by 330% since 2010. So that's again how there has been buy-in in terms of, you know, fact, well, yeah, this is, we need to have a tough social security system. This is about about being fair but being tough. The other point I wanted to make very briefly, if I may, is if you actually map the incident of incapacity benefit, employment support allowance, the social security support that's provided for people who are chronically sick or disabled, it reflects our industrial heritage. It is a recognised population health indicator. So the point that you're making, it is flatlining. And the type of thing that we have seen in the film around sanctioning, around the work capability assessment, this is part of the process to get people off flow, as they call it. The job centres are their performance managed on how quickly they get people off flow. And I have had whistleblowers come to me, one again also in my constituency, who said that this is about targeting people. We are set targets to get people off flow, even if they haven't done anything wrong. So I'm starting from the point that Ken has been saying, that we need to value, we remember why it was established after the Second World War. It is there for any one of us, like the NHS, should we fall on hard times, should we become sick and disabled. If you think 9 out of 10 people acquire their illness or disability, as I say, it could happen to any of us. And the fifth richest country in the world, I think we should value it and recognise that.
Very, very useful comments. I should say that there are other political perspectives as well on this debate, just to be absolutely clear about that. The RSA is an independent institution. Ken, would you like to sort of make some final comments in reflection of those three questions? There was one about government having a responsibility to create employment, two, the experience of migrants, Debbie's comments, and then some final thoughts from you.
Yes, I agree with you. I think it's a government's task to provide full employment. You know, when I was young, that was every political party claimed it would produce full employment in different ways. Labour by public investment, Tories by, as they would say, freeing up business. And there was a choice on how you would achieve it. But that was the intention. And there was a fear that people wouldn't get elected unless they produced full employment. And I think that in 1979, that was one of on that very day, full employment ceased to be what the government said they would achieve. And, you know, Margaret Thatcher says she'll turn the country, would turn the country around, and she did. Backwards. but I absolutely agree with you. Full employment. Every kid at school should know that there's a place for them. At the moment, they know that there probably isn't a place for them. Most of them know they will struggle to find somewhere to live. You know, I mean, it's becoming even a middle class worry now. You know, and that's serious. That's a serious abdication of government. That's saying, we don't care, over to the market. And the market won't provide. If there's no profit to be made, the market won't provide, fulfil the need. And I think that's time we recognise that. And the evidence is all around us. The situation for migrants, I mean, they suffer in public opinion in both ways, don't they? I mean, they're vilified because they need support, and they're vilified because they speak differently or they have they're deemed to be from outside. And again, that comes from a mismanaged European Union, which has used labour. This may be contentious. They've used labour, they've put it into a free market so the employer can say, OK, I'll employ you, but I won't employ you because you're more expensive. And they've used cheap labour to undermine collective agreements, and I think they've driven the European Union. I think that in the interests of business, well, big business, corporations, and they've driven it, and privatisation is a key part of the European Union's directives. So, you know, it's being complicated for the left, because you don't want to support an economic organisation which is going to undermine trade unions, for example, and set worker against worker. Equally, people are internationalists and they want to cooperate and they want to work together. So I think the European Union has been a difficult issue for Labour to square that, for the left generally, and the different views. But yes, I mean, migrants suffer. I think we have to argue for a different Europe that equalises the economies, you know, and then absolutely have freedom of movements, because then, you know, you're not
you're not putting people in a situation where they have to leave home to get to support themselves. But absolutely, freedom. I'm sure in gatherings like this, freedom of movement is perfect because we can all travel to each other's countries and work. But at the blue collar end, it's not so simple, I think.
So a final thought for the audience tonight. What's the final thing you want them to take away with
us? I've tested your patience already.
No,
so,
you haven't.
Because I'm old and I don't care, I'm going to really test your patience. I think this is intolerable. It is intolerable that we live like this. It's intolerable that we humiliate people at such a scale where in the last time figures were available, in 2015, there were 1,100,000 food bags given out. 1,100,000. 500,000 of those were to kids. Now, there's more than one child in each, you know, in each family that's getting it, so there's probably 1 million children. 1 million children not eating unless you put something in a supermarket collecting bag. You know, that's intolerable. How do we change it? We all our sensibilities say it's wrong. It won't change a lot until we organise and make it happen. It won't change, you know. And so how do we organise? I think, as the old Joe Hill used to say, the American trade unionists, don't mourn, organise. How do we organise? I think we have a chance. I think we have a historic moment. Because I'm not a member of the Labour Party, have a historic moment where you have a leadership which actually stands with people in struggle. You have the first Labour leader, I think, ever, since before Ramsay MacDonald, the first Labour leader who has stood on a picket line with people on strike, junior doctors, steel workers in South Wales, and given his unequivocal support for the drivers defending safety in Southern Rail. And some of you may have your lives ruined by Southern Rail, so this might not be wholly popular. But to have that, to have someone who stands with the working class people of this country, who doesn't reject them, you know, like Blair and Brown and Miliband and the rest, who doesn't decry them when they try to defend what they have to defend. That's an absolutely historic moment. That leadership would remove this. They won't get the chance if their MPs, not Debbie, if their MPs put the knife in between their ribs. And yet you have this huge membership, the largest party in Western Europe, a huge membership supporting that leadership, and the clique between them determined to pull the leadership down. Now, if that is allowed to happen, then this will stay, because the leadership that will come into the Labour Party will follow the politics of Blair and Brown, because that's where they came into politics under that. So if we want to change this, we've got to be active in your constituency Labour Party, in your trade union, if the trade union is here, then, and absolutely defend that leadership. I think it's very precise, because we can have all the right feelings we want to, but it won't change unless we politically organise to make it change. And that's the only way I see doing it. You know, in 4 or 5 years, we could have a government that would stop this, that would invest in work, where people would really feel part of the world that they lived in and not be humiliated and rejected. But we've got to organise in a very precise way to get it.
Ken, I knew for sure you'd get me into trouble tonight, and you definitely have. But just to emphasise, the RSA is an independent charity. But can I just say thank you very much for your time, for your thoughts, but most importantly for this very important piece of work that we've all been able to view and experience tonight. The DVD is out next week.
Soon,
next week. I'd also like to thank Organic PR, who have collaborated with us on putting this evening together. It was a great conversation, a great movie, a great moment. Thank you very much, Ken Loach.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.